They covered it for The Guardian. They basically came to the conclusion that these people's stories didn't line up, that the most serious allegations against him were not credible.
When I became romantically involved with Jacob, I clearly told him I wasn't interested in group sex or having sex in front of other people. I blacked out, and when I came back into consciousness, Jacob was having sex with me in the living room with his friends watching.
So that's the rape allegation.
Most of the witnesses from those days no longer want to talk.
This is obviously very emotional for me.
Yeah, I understand. You're doing great. Thank you.
But one does finally agree to discuss the night in question.
One of the reasons why I was determined to, like, talk about this in public was because the painting that was drawn from Chelsea in her anonymous blog post is just simply not what happened that night at the apartment. It became a movie night. I don't remember if that was the plan or what, but by the time the movie started, the couch was laid out. It was my two friends and then Chelsea and Jake. So those two couples were there on the couch together under a blanket, and then I was just off to the side. It was a projector on the wall, so it was like making the room fairly bright.
And what was her degree of participation, I guess, in whatever was or wasn't going on?
Well, I mean, there wasn't anything going on. I mean, as far as I knew, we were all casually hanging out watching a film, and two different couples were cuddling with themselves separate from each other. There wasn't anything substantial that happened. It was just a very relaxed movie night. There was nothing that eluded me to think that they were either naked or having sexual relations under the blanket. Like, the vibe that she was describing, like, it was very malicious. It was very, not hateful, but, like, it was terrible. She made it sound like if any bystander had been, like, in that apartment, that someone should have, like, yelled and stopped, like, you know, what you're doing is wrong. But, like, the vibe of that night was just completely the opposite.
My conclusion is, from talking to all the eyewitnesses, that Chelsea seemed fine, that she seemed comfortable, that she was involved with Jacob. So I couldn't corroborate the rape allegation.
It was nothing like what was described on the website, even remotely, that they weren't having sex, they were watching a movie.
So the Jacob Applebaum that you met was just incredibly paranoid.
No matter what happens, even if there's a videotape of it, it was murder. Julian and I used to joke about that. Laura and I used to joke about that too. No matter what happens, even if there's a note, no matter what, I would never commit suicide. If it ever happened in such a way, it was murder. We used to joke about those things until we actually had friends that were found dead from suicide. So do you have any other questions for me?
When you meet him, you enter this world that is so unfamiliar to most of us. You know, he's walking around Berlin and he's saying, okay, those people are on a surveillance team, those people are on a surveillance team. And you're like, really? I mean, maybe they're just buying gelato. You know, maybe they're just like pushing a stroller. You know, maybe that is a real baby in there. Or I guess he figures he was important enough they'd spring for a real baby. But it was a question for me all along. Is he paranoid or are they really out to get him?
Now, my understanding is that the U.S. Justice Department at one point offers Jacob Applebaum a deal, kind of a get-out-of-jail-quick card amnesty, which is really interesting because he's never been charged with anything. But they basically said, if you want to make sure that that stays the case and have full amnesty, here's a deal that will make those hypothetical problems go away.
At a certain point, the Department of Justice offered him a deal. And it is an interesting when you say, what are the charges against him? Well, all of this happens this is the kind of gaslighting of the whole process. These things happen. They're sealed indictments done by a secretive grand jury. And you don't know what's in the box, you know, until it's opened. And like Assange, you're facing 175 years for espionage. And the prospect of alluding to these people, to these associates, that there may be such an indictment against them is part of what breaks their spirit and breaks up the movement.
You don't know what we got on you.
You don't know what you got on you is almost worse.
But this is confirmation. If he's wondering, like, am I just fantasizing this whole thing? They're saying, no, we will give you amnesty against everything that we're going to do to you otherwise. And what does he have to do in return?
He has to tell them everything he knows about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. And this offer from the Department of Justice came up while we were filming. So had there been any doubt in my mind prior to that, which I think after a couple of years working with him, I believed enough of it was true. But this was the absolute confirmation. When you haven't even been told what the charges against you are, but they're offering to drop them if you rat out your comrade, I think you know you're not imagining the hot water you're in.
And what was his response to that offer?
Well, he told them to go f*** themselves, I believe, in so many words.
And so the U.S. government said they'd like to know if I'd be interested in coming in from the cold. Everything would go away. I could come back to America. And they said, essentially just one thing. We just need you to testify against Julian Assange. So I told them that I will die on foreign soil before I ever let you get your f***ing hands on me. I'm so glad you clapped.
I think of the cast of characters who represented what seemed to me to be an unstoppable new force in how information moves and the inability for governments to keep secrets. And I think of Edward Snowden, who is exiled to Russia. Julian Assange, who apparently has gone mad in his imprisonment or, de facto imprisonment.
Or so the only people, who write about him say, yeah.
And then we have Jacob Applebaum.
Right.
They were surprisingly effective at stopping this thing. Jamie, do we know who is behind this?
I was not able to find a smoking gun in this story. There have been suggestions of FBI associations of this accuser or that accuser and glimpses of evidence. There have been, allegations of CIA associations of this journalist or that one. But I wasn't able to find it. And in the end, to me, it's kind of a unique and cautionary tale even without that. One of the journalists I interviewed, Angela Richter, in the piece, who's covered Assange and collaborated at one time with Applebaum, as she says in the film, if this was not orchestrated by the U.S. Secret Services, it may as well have been. They must be sitting back, eating popcorn, and enjoying the fallout. Because basically, this scandal destroyed that whole movement. It destroyed the whole movement around Tor. The browser still exists, but the movement, for all intents and purposes, no longer does.
And the kind of surveillance that Tor existed to protect against is now just a part of our lives.
Yes. I mean, this is the other odd and horrifying thing is after all of these revelations, after all these risks taken by whistleblowers and journalists, somehow we have the information and we've forgotten about it. I don't know if it's because of the news cycle or because we're too dependent on the technology to bother worrying about what cookies are or how they might be used against us.
As far as I can see, WikiLeaks, which for a time had a barn burner of a release every other week, it now just seems to be like an Assange advocacy organization.
Yeah, they're kind of fighting for his life.
Okay, see you tomorrow.
Yeah.
Next year,
my team and I spent over 2 years chasing more than 40 people to talk about Jake. Tor people, alleged victims, friends, foes, and only the handful you've met agreed. And pretty nervously.
Okay.
Now, why should people be afraid to speak freely in a community dedicated to internet freedom?
I think we'll leave it at that for today.
Are you sure? Because I can keep going for another hour.
Yeah, I don't think I can.
No?
Jamie Kastner, thank you for talking with me today.
Thank you for having me. At least somebody wants to talk about Jacob Applebaum.
That is your Canada Land. You can email me at jesse@canadaland.com. I read every email that you send. Our website is canadaland.com. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Tristan Capicchione is our audio producer and editor. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Max Collins is our production manager. I'm your host, Jesse Brown. Our theme music is by So Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Joanna Chu, author of China Unbound, former BC bureau chief of the Toronto Star, currently the China editor at Rest of World. Hello.
Hi, Jesse.
Joanna, today on the show, the secret list of allegedly treasonous Canadians now includes newspapers. And then we will answer the age-old question, if 50,000 Jews go for a walk in the city but nobody's there to report it, do they make a sound? Welcome to Shortcuts, where we talk shit about the news. So, we duly note stories and things in the media that people really need to pay attention to that might otherwise fall through the cracks. Joanna, what would you like to duly note today?
Yeah, so my new organization, Rest of World, is a nonprofit that covers the impact of technology around the world outside the Silicon Valley bubble. I think it's so important that we really track and care about what's happening with technology around the world. So I'm really proud of what we do as a nonprofit to try to do things like fight misinformation. So we talked about the use of AI in spreading fake news. So we have a completely free, everything on our website is free, no paywall, election tracker of how AI tools are being used around the world to influence voters. And this is crowdsourced, as well as journalists are contributing to it. So I don't see a lot of entries about AI manipulation happening in trying to manipulate Canadian voters. So I just want to do a call out if you want to make sure and contribute to monitoring of what's happening in Canada with AI's use in misinformation targeting Canadians, please go on our website, restofworld.org, and submit your entry, whatever you notice.
This is a really cool project, restofworld.org, and you need Canadians to report when they see AI manipulation in politics. That's what you're asking for. Who funds Rest of World?
So it was founded by Sophie Schmidt. She's the daughter of Eric Schmidt, former Google CEO. And it's a nonprofit, so other donors donate to it. We get grants. It's a nonprofit that's well-funded and has a mission to actually hire local journalists, like hire and train journalists around the world, like India, Southeast Asia, to build capacity around the world for tech reporting that kind of has this kind of like social justice impact driven mindset.
Okay, restofworld.org. Everybody check it out. Duly noted. I would like to duly note an issue with last week's episode of Shortcuts, guest hosted by Justin Ling. This is not a correction per se. Let's call it a clarification about a segment in which this whole legislative thing that's forcing Google to pay money into news organizations. It was discussed last week on the show. So to refresh your memory, there were these two different groups that wanted the middleman job. Google's not actually cutting checks to the news organizations. There needs to be this collective that handles this $100 million a year and sends the checks out to qualifying newsrooms. And there were two different collectives that were trying to get that job, and Google gets to decide which collective they were going to pick. One collective was this group that was formed out of the newspaper lobby group. And one group was formed by a ragtag handful of indie publishers. This was the dark horse candidate. Nobody thought they were going to get it. And Justin Ling was talking about how, like, they surprised everybody when Google gave this role to them. I have to disclose whenever I talk about this stuff that I have a business interest in all of this because I'm a news publisher who stands to get some of this Google money. But I actually stayed out of this particular fight, which of these intermediaries should get the job of handing out the Google money. I didn't back either of them. Now, What is this clarification? Justin Ling is a super news reporter, and like most news reporters, he knows almost nothing about the news publishing business. And as a result, I think that listeners of last week's episode could reasonably have come away from the segment thinking that this intermediary, this scrappy collective of indie publishers that was chosen by Google, would be the ones to decide who gets the money and who doesn't. I think that that is probably what a lot of people thought when they listened to that segment. And Justin raised some concerns about, well, if they have that power, who are they going to favor? This is not really the case. The collective does not decide which news organization gets Google money and which news organization does not get Google money. They don't say, we like the indies, we don't like the rebel, we don't like the old newspapers, we like ourselves. They do not get to make that determination. If a news organization is determined by the CRA, by Revenue Canada, to be a QCJO, a Qualified Canadian Journalism Organization, and CanadaLand just got its status as such, we still don't take government money, but we are going to accept this Google money if our competitors are getting it too. So if CRA gives you that designation, you get some of this Google money. And if you don't get QCJO designation, then it goes to the CRTC, and they determine. The CRTC will determine if you get the money. And if you get the money, it's, as far as I know, fairly distributed. Basically, every full-time employee or equivalent gets the same amount of this Google money. Doesn't matter if you're the Globe and Mail or CanadaLand or, you know, anybody else. So what does it matter which collective is chosen? What is this collective actually deciding? There are some finer points here. They do have the job of figuring out if a news organization is lying about how many employees it has to get more money. It'll probably be the collective that does the auditing of that. They're involved in dispute resolution. There's probably little ways that they could like show favoritism, but Ling may have a point there. There may be some bias possible, but the big picture here, no, this is not who gets to decide who's getting who's real news and who gets money from Google. And the final thing I want to say about this, Joanna, is why? Why this upset where Google did not go with this mainstream News Media Canada newspaper lobby group? Why did they choose this ragtag group of indie publications that most people have never heard of, this collective? In my opinion, and it's something that I've been discussing in phone calls with people who are kind of in the backroom side of this, players involved in this, the reason why Google said, like, F- you to the newspaper lobby was because the newspaper lobby has just spent the last 5 years on Google. They ran like a national ad campaign about how Facebook and Google steal the news. They weaponized their editorial pages to on Google. They have been like very purposely trying to give Google bad publicity to force them to cough up money. And so Google is saying, well, why would we? There's a 2% fee that the collective takes, and that's $2 million a year. So Google gets to decide who gets $2 million a year. So are they going to give it to a bunch of digital upstart news publications, or are they going to give it to the newspaper lobby that's been a pain in their ass? I think it was spite. I think that's what happened. Why would we give this to you?
And it also reflects like the context of Google's strategy in trying to fight being forced to pay news outlets.
Yeah.
Duly noted.
Joanna, that's Shortcuts this week. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Joanna, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter or X at my name, Joanna Chu. And yeah, check out my new publication, The Rest of World. I think they really do really important work, and I'm happy to be there.
Restofworld.org. This episode is produced by James Nicholson with additional production by Caleb Thompson. Our production manager is Max Collins. Our editor-in-chief is Karen Pugliese. Theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
You know what I'm talking about. I'm not myself. I'm desperate to be calm. Desperate to feel well, and I'm not doing well. Can't get through a day without a friend and a pill to help me. You are the same. You know what I'm talking about.
Are you looking for reliable and free resources to navigate the digital world safely? Look no further. Media Smarts is here to help. From learning how to protect your privacy to managing screen time, Media Smarts offers all kinds of free resources for everyone about life online. Learn how to spot fake news with the help of the House Hippo. Think critically about the media all around you. And find ways to empower yourself online. Visit mediasmarts.ca today and learn the skills you need to thrive in the digital age.